Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to New York City, New York for a State of the Science Summit on multiple myeloma. Although the treatment paradigm in multiple myeloma is guided by transplant eligibility and grounded in the use of immunomodulatory drugs, proteasome inhibitors, and monoclonal antibodies, certain elements of practice are not as well described. Therefore, we sat down with AJ Chari, MD, and Sundar Jagannath, MD, both of Mount Sinai Hospital, to provide insight on controversial but critical questions regarding the merits of quadruplet versus triplet therapy in the newly diagnosed setting, the optimal maintenance approach in high-risk patients, and the data in support of and against initiating treatment in patients with smoldering multiple myeloma. Dr. Chari is an associate professor of hematology and medical oncology at Mount Sinai Hospital, and Dr. Jagannath is a professor of medicine, hematology, and medical oncology at the Tisch Cancer Institute at Mount Sinai Hospital. First, we hear from Dr. Chari, who presented a case of a patient with slight proteinuria. After additional workup, the patient was found to have normal calcium, normal kidney function, stable hemoglobin, and no bone pain. However, the patient had an elevated pre-light chain ratio. Listen on to hear the complete case presentation from Dr. Chari.
So today we'll start with a 65-year-old patient who has been previously healthy, was found to have slight proteinuria, and so then additional workup was done, and this led to the finding of normal calcium, normal kidney function, stable hemoglobin of 13, no bone pain, but there was an elevated free light chain of approximately, the lambda was 150, the kappa was 1, and the ratio was elevated to over, the involved to uninvolved ratio was 150. The Benz-Jones protein was 50 milligrams per day. And the bone marrow was done and showed 11% lambda-restricted plasma cells. And so the patient was diagnosed with lambda light chain smoldering myeloma. And the question becomes, what to do with this patient?
This is an interesting case because nowadays, in the myeloma defining event, one of the myeloma defining event is kappa lambda ratio greater than 100 with involved light chain greater than 100. So this patient does meet the myeloma defining event. So a physician in practice could consider this patient as multiple myeloma and may offer treatment. But what is unique about this particular case is that myeloma defining event of the kappa lambda ratio greater than 100 only applies to patients with IgG and IgA myeloma with light chain. There is a completely different entity called light chain monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance and a light chain smoldering myeloma, which is an entity by itself. This patient will fall into light chain smoldering myeloma and not a case of myeloma defining event that this patient actually has myeloma because he has free lambda light chain greater than 100 and the involved light chain, that is lambda to kappa ratio greater than 100. If we pay attention to that, because the bone marrow gave us a clue that there was only about 11% plasma cell in the aspirate, the biopsy could be variable, but usually it ranges in this case between 10 to 20% because the biopsy is usually given a range, not specific number, whereas aspirate will have a good number. The rest of the evaluation came back negative. This patient does not have renal impairment, does not have significant proteinuria because it's a lambda light chain disease. Sometimes these patients can have amyloidosis of the kidney and give rise to tremendous amount of proteinuria, but not Benz-Jones proteinuria. So this patient did not have significant amount of proteinuria from what you presented, except for IFE being positive, there was not significant measurable Benz-Jones proteinuria. And the overall proteinuria was also less than 150 milligram per 24 hours. So going carefully, looking at all these things. The patient had no anemia, renal impairment, no bone disease, and the patient had no history of frequent infections, and the light chains were, abnormal, but did not have significant bench-shown proteinuria or non-specific proteinuria, I would feel comfortable calling this patient as a lambda light chain smoldering myeloma. The natural history of progression for lambda light chain smoldering myeloma as opposed to IgG and IgA is actually a little lower. Normally we quote 10% per year for the first 5 years, whereas the light chain smoldering myeloma has only 5% per year for the first 5 years, then it goes down to 3%. So actually these patients actually are less aggressive. So it is interesting case that you brought up.
So I guess I would ask, I think an interesting discussion would be the initial myeloma consensus criteria were designed to say, since our treatments are getting so good and so well tolerated and highly efficacious, do we need to wait for CRAB symptoms to develop if somebody's truly gonna have high risk smoldering myeloma? And the initial retrospective studies that were done showed that, the risk of FLCR greater than 100 involved or uninvolved had a approximately 80 to 98% risk of progression at 2 years. And those were retrospective studies, and the consensus group discussion was, if your risk of progression at 2 years is 80% or higher, shouldn't we treat those patients? So one of the interesting questions becomes, if these retrospective studies that were initially done that led to the biomarker-defined myeloma, somebody in the community you alluded to could see this patient and say, oh, your ratio is more than 100, we should treat you.
That is correct. As a matter of fact, patients have come to me in whom the treatment has been initiated, and I have actually counseled against it and stopped the treatment. So the distinction here is, if the patient had IgG or IgA myeloma, there is an M spike, and the ratio is abnormal, which doesn't come out well in the publication, then this patient meets the myeloma-defining event. And typically in these patients, the plasma cell percentages could have been 20%, but then it would meet the myeloma-defining event. This patient, on the contrary, is purely a light chain myeloma, which is not what is in the myeloma-defining event alludes to. And that's where subtlety comes.
So let's change this case to same patient, but now the bone marrow is 30%. It is IgG lambda myeloma, so there's a heavy chain component. The M spike is 2.5, but the ratio is still over 100. Would you treat this patient if they had the slightly higher marrow involvement, but also had a heavy chain component?
Okay, now you're bringing where right now the evidence-based medicine or IMWG criteria would indicate this patient has a lambda to kappa ratio greater than 100, and the free lambda itself was 150 milligram per liter or 15 milligram per deciliter, and had bone marrow greater than, had 30% plasmacytosis. Under those circumstances, the retrospective study you quoted, they say that the incidence of renal impairment in those patients is 20%, etc. Within the first 2 years, the risk could be high, so the patient could be treated. But I have been in this field long, so I'm an old timer, and we used to wait on these patients. So I would rather see the patient monthly for the first 3 months and every 3 months for the first year, because what I'm missing is I have a snapshot, but the snapshot shows only 30% plasma cells. I do not know how long it has been there. The kidney is not impaired right now. I agree that renal impairment is higher in patients with high kappa lambda ratio, etc. While I'm cognizant of the fact, I would like to see evolution of this disease, and rather than act on the finding alone immediately. So I would not personally treat, but I would not say if somebody treated that they were wrong, because the way the definitions are, it doesn't clarify these kind of details.
I agree. I think a couple of things. First is, before we start talking about treating high-risk patients, we need to agree on what high-risk is. And the second is that early treatment benefits these patients. So to the first point, we did a retrospective study of our own patients. This was approximately 300 patients. And we had about 200 of those were elevated free light chains. And the risk of progression in our hands at 2 years is only 44%. And the only prospective study that's been done, which is by the Danish, and that was published in a European Journal of Hematology, was only 30%. So it's important to remember that when retrospective studies are done at academic medical centers, there may be a referral bias or, potentially more high-risk patients are being seen, and we may not be capturing the same as what a prospective registry would capture. And so I agree that part of the risk definition, when we looked into our multivariate analysis, not only did free light chain ratio not come out, even bone marrow more than 60%, which is another biomarker-defined event, neither one came out. And I think that's important because the consensus literature on which the bone marrow more than 60% came out was only 45 patients globally. And we all know that marrow can be very heterogeneously involved in myeloma. So if you had 60% in one area, you could very well have 30% in another area. And what's more important than that is really the hemoglobin, because if truly a patient had 60% plasma cells and their hemoglobin remained at 13 to 14, I would be very suspicious of a sampling issue. And so what we found was that it's really the evolving features that seem to predict myeloma. It was evolving hemoglobin, meaning decreasing in hemoglobin approximately 1.6, but not meeting the myeloma definition of drop of 2 or below 10. It was an increase in the light chains approximately 170% or M spike 64%. So I think as you referred to, Dr. Jagannath referred to, that more than looking at a photograph, we should look at the movie. And if the photograph is concerning, but the movie is boring, we have our answer. And I'm curious, and to the second point is, we don't even have good data for that treating these, because randomized evidence-based medicine would say we should take these patients that we think are high risk and randomize them to treatment or not. And then if early treatment benefits, that's how we would implement. But the FLCR in ratio greater than 100, there is no prospective study that treating these patients benefits. And I think it's hard to justify that when the data are so heterogeneous in terms of risk of progression ranging from 30% to 80%. I guess the other question we could discuss is, speaking to the randomized data, is the recent data that was presented at ASCO by Dr. Lonial about treating these intermediate to high-risk patients with smoldering disease with lenalidomide and showing that there was a PFS benefit. Does this change your practice?
That's a very good question, that they had done the study and they reported in ASCO, and now it is actually published, I believe, in Lancet Oncology, mm-hmm. right? So it is published in Lancet Oncology. My take-home message, I look at this field in this way. So if you have smoldering myeloma and you pointed out the treatment for myeloma is getting better and better, so there are two schools of thoughts moving forward. One school of thought is that the myeloma defining event is already happened in this patient, what we call as the founder clone was already established when it was MGUS, and now it is steadily progressing towards multiple myeloma. So if I take a bone marrow and send it for genomics from a myeloma patient, and I also send a bone marrow blinded from a multiple myeloma patient with lytic lesion and send it for genomics, based on the genomics or FISH or genetic analysis, the can't distinguish between smoldering myeloma and multiple myeloma at this time. So I find that this definition, it is not clear genomically it's any different. If it is not genomically different, then the question is, because the treatment is safer, should we treat them early and more effectively with a curative intent and eradicate the clone? So that is the approach the Spanish Patima group investigated took. They originally published on lenalidomide dexamethasone combination, which is standard frontline therapy, the so-called first therapy, which was getting approved around that time. So they used lenalidomide dexamethasone as the treatment of choice and compared it with people not being treated. That one was published in New England Journal of Medicine, and it introduced a lot of controversy, how we are defining smoldering myeloma, whether some of them were actually multiple myeloma or things like that. But they clearly showed that earlier treatment was beneficial. Then they went to the next level. They have gone to use three drug combination, KRD, followed by stem cell transplant, followed by consolidation with KRD, and subsequently maintenance. My feeling is preliminary results are out, but my feeling is this will show a higher number of patients in complete remission, and they will show that the PFS for the treated will always look better because you are in remission, so progression-free will be better. Compared to patients who are not treated, obviously they will be progressing at a steady state. But what I'm not clear is that if the patients on the control arm are followed closely, and then they are implemented on treatment, so it's like early versus late transplant, early versus delayed treatment of a smoldering myeloma, will not show a survival advantage. That's my gut feeling. And I base it on the fact that you cannot really yet tell me the distinction in the genomic characteristic of a smoldering myeloma and a multiple myeloma. So they are already multiple clones already established, a lot of genomic complexities already established. So I think the survival advantage would not show up for quite a while. Now, on the flip side of it, there's a group of people feeling, oh my God, these patients' quality of life is so good, the smoldering myeloma, because by definition, they have no organ toxicity, they have no end organ damage, otherwise they will qualify for amyloidosis or MGRS or something. So they have no end organ damage, they have no symptom, they are not even anemic. So under those circumstances, treatment will produce side effects, no matter what it is said, whatever is palatable. Even monoclonal antibody, there is a side effect, having to come for infusion, going through treatment, etc. So they felt like maybe taking the least innocuous position by trying to change the natural history by giving lenalidomide alone. So they tried that. There have been elotuzumab alone. There is also daratumumab alone. All of these studies do show that there is improvement in progression-free survival. But actually, the complete response rate is very, very low. And in the lenalidomide trial of Sagalonial, patients, half of them dropped out of the study because they couldn't continue lenalidomide beyond a year and a half at the most. So my feeling is they did not put them into complete remission. The disease is still there. And in a smoldering myeloma, they wonder, doc, my myeloma has not gone down. What are we doing? I'm taking this pill. I have diarrhea or I have this rash. What am I supposed to do? So I think I don't know whether that is a major breakthrough. So for me, neither is satisfactory, but in patients who are evolving and have aggressive, then I like to treat a little bit earlier than before, but I don't subscribe necessarily to either of them. I would rather like to watch the patient and understand their evolution and then decide on treatment.
I agree. I mean, I think if you look at this, the recent Len versus observation, the ECOG study, yes, there was a PFS improvement. The hazard ratio is quite impressive, 0.28, but it was only 90 patients in each arm. And as when you look at the breakdown, the curves really only separate in the truly high-risk patients, of which there were only 15 patients in each arm. The standard-risk patients, the low-risk patients, the curves are almost superimposable. So it goes back to, if we're going to treat early, you need to know who needs the treatment. We shouldn't be treating low-risk patients because their natural history is so good. And you, as you alluded to, the response rate was only 50% with Len. It was not a 90-plus percent. Okay. We'd have no data regarding the prevention of CRAB symptoms, which is the most important. Of course, you know that the paraproteins will go down, but does that translate into clinical benefits such as delayed in CRAB symptoms or PFS in terms of myeloma developing end organ complications or most importantly, OS. There was actually also an increase in secondary malignancy, 11 versus 5% at 3 years. And we have no PFS to or OS data. And that's important because we know already in newly diagnosed patients, when they're continuing induction, transplant, and Len maintenance, patients who become Len refractory have an inferior outcome to those who are not. And so if you're taking Len smoldering patients, making them Len refractory, this PFS to OS is really important to look at as well. And I don't think we're going to have that. And as you alluded to, there's a 50% Len discontinuation rate, making this the quality of life tolerability an important question. So I agree. I think we need better data. And it goes back to making sure we're picking the right patient population and then showing that the treatment actually benefits in terms of not just reducing their paraprotein, but delaying CRAB symptoms and ideally overall survival.
So it is interesting, I didn't pick this up before. So you are saying that the PFS, first of all, is that it didn't improve in low-risk patients because the low-risk patients are not progressing, and so they did equally well. So the LEN could not show a difference. But there was difference in PFS in the intermediate and maybe definitely in high risk. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is that there is nothing like a PFS too. So by starting earlier, so yes, there is a PFS difference. There is no OS difference. And we do not know whether by starting lenalidomide ahead, we actually compromise the patient for subsequent therapy, which would be reflected in second PFS or PFS2, as you pointed out. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't think about PFS2 at all.
I think that's especially important when you're doing preventative strategies, right? Whether you're in smoldering, in maintenance, you have to show that these interventions, which are in healthy patients, is not compromising later outcomes. And I think we've seen that in LEN maintenance in post-transplant, there is no compromise. If anything, there's an OS benefit. But we don't have any long-term follow-up, and this is a very small study anyway. And I think the last part of smoldering myeloma that we would be important to cover is the bone disease, right? So it's important, if you're not treating somebody, to really be thorough about the bone disease, either a PET CT or MRI, to make sure that they don't have any osseous disease. But I think the other story that often gets left out is it makes sense that if patients have multifocal disease on MRI, they're going to have a lower risk, they're going to have a higher risk of progression. So that's why the new one of the myeloma defining characteristics, MDEs, is more than one focal MRI lesion, and it's because the median PFS is 13 months if you have one versus not reached. But the Germans did another part of the study which doesn't get as much attention, which is if you had focal lesions, and it could even be more than one, but they were stable over time, those patients did just as well as those who never had any lesions. And so it goes back to, again, the evolving features. It's the people who you have the most concern about are the lesions evolving. And I actually have a patient who just crossed 2 years. He has three stable focal lesions on MRI that have not changed. He has no other Krebs symptoms. And we say that the highest risk of progression is that first 2 years, and he's been completely stable. And so I think, again, it goes back to making sure we know who's truly high risk before we just start throwing therapy at everyone.
This one, I actually did not know that, you know, the Germans had published that they actually observed some patients who had lesions by MRI over a period of time, and mm-hmm. those who did not evolve, they did as well as patients.
Yeah.
This, you know, as an old timer, this was called as indolent myeloma, coined by Ray Alexanian. So if somebody had a small lytic lesion in the skull or whatever, they were not initiated on treatment. And, you know, this is 1980s. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the best treatment. So we observed these patients, and some of them never progressed. So that has been reported as indolent myeloma. But now, in the modern era, I truly was not aware that they had published that they had observed patients after an MRI finding. Is it an MRI finding or even PET CT finding?
This is only MRI.
This is only MRI finding.
Focal lesion.
Because right now, any lytic lesion, even one by PET CT, is supposed to be chance for treatment. And I always thought about Ray Alexanian, where we had lytic lesion by skeletal survey, especially on the skull, and we never treated them, and it was defined as indolent myeloma. But now you find a subtle lytic lesion, or even mm-hmm. on a PET CT, we are supposed to treat. But the MRI paper, I was not aware. Thank you.
Next, Dr. Chari presents a case of a patient who presents with bone pain. After initial workup, the patient is found to have hypercalcemia, mild renal insufficiency, and multifocal disease on imaging. Listen on to hear the complete case presentation from Dr. Chari.
We have another patient who is 65 years old, previously just hypertension, well controlled, and presents with bone pain, is found to have hypercalcemia, mild renal insufficiency, creatinine clearance is 50, creatinine is 1.3, hemoglobin is 11, and multifocal disease on PET scan. Bone marrow biopsy shows 60% plasma cells with deletion 17P noted, and also amplification of chromosome 1. Patient has an elevated IgG and lambda, and M spike is 4, and beta 2 microglobulin is elevated, as is LDH. So this is a revised IFS 3. What would your treatment be for this patient?
So the patient is 65 years of age, physically fit with no organ damage, even though he's hypercalcemic, there is no significant renal impairment, but has multifocal skeletal involvement. So the patient obviously merits treatment right away. This is an area where the patient has genetic information by FISH. He has deletion 17P. And he also has gain of 1Q. He has elevated LDH. And because of hypercalcemia, mild renal impairment, his beta 2 microglobulin is greater than 5.5. So he falls into ISS stage 3. Now, revised ISS. ISS is to me, is remarkable for multiple myeloma in the sense ISS has always held true in newly diagnosed myeloma patient, even in relapsed myeloma patient. It can be added to the other, but the ISS will always add value when you add it. So when investigators went and added for the revised ISS, they took into the LDH and they added the cytogenetics. They did not have gain of 1Q in that one. They did have 17P deletion, 414, and 1416, and 1420. So they had the MAF translocation and the 14 and a 414 translocation and deletion 17P. So this patient did have deletion 17P. So this is revised ISS. Revised ISS stage 3 uniformly has not done well. That would be considered high risk. Now the question is, before dissecting about each one of those genetic abnormalities, this is a high-risk patient for me, and how do we want to manage? We always started out with triple regimen, and I used to come up with the VRD as our standard of care before. Then later on came additional agent, carfilzomib, so KRD has come up. And my personal feeling is young, fit patient, this patient is 65, but no significant comorbidities, would be able to tolerate the carfilzomib. So KRD with carfilzomib at 56 milligram per meter square, not 70, so 56 milligram per meter square with Revlimid and dexamethasone is a good option.
How many times per week are you giving?
Once a week, then a once weekly Kyprolis. And then the third option, now I'm a little bit more interested, is to use the combination of four-drug combination, VRD plus daratumumab. The reason I like the addition of daratumumab, we have the proteasome inhibitor, we have the immunomodulatory drug, we have the steroid, and all of these work in a certain way, whereas the daratumumab, being an anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody, it works in the immunological way and is geared towards the surface of the tumor cells. So it could eliminate tumor cells by binding to the surface and using ADCC or complement or any one of those mechanisms. So it is, to me, somewhat agnostic to that genetics. So for me, this will be an added drug to the treatment armamentarium. So that is much more appealing. But I do know that you are much more closer to the data on the frontline therapy with monoclonal antibody. So I would be interested to see what you have to say. My choice would be VRD plus daratumumab. And you can ask why not KRD plus daratumumab. I feel like if I use the VRD plus daratumumab, the Venn diagram would have covered. So I do not know, do I get extra with the K versus V in the situation? So VRD is better tolerated in my hand, so I feel VRD plus DARA would be my choice. But I'm happy to hear you, how you look at it, and especially the role of monoclonal antibodies.
But I think, as you alluded to, the choices are basically RVD or VRD, KRD, DARA plus VRD or DARA plus KRD, and we have from Europe DARA VTD. So it's basically PI-IMID DEX plus or minus the monoclonal. And so I think when we're trying to do cross-study comparisons, obviously there's this tendency like, okay, which of these is the best? And we would want to look at the evidence. And when I've looked at this, one of the complexities, there's two main differences that are across these studies. One is, how many days of induction chemo did each of these regimens use? And I think why this is important, because we can see, for example, when you compare the outcomes of stamina versus EMN, which is the role of post-transplant, is there a benefit of consolidation? Is there a benefit of second transplant? EMN showed benefit the American study stamina, there wasn't. And part of that is, I think, what happened to these patients before transplant. In the US, there's tremendous heterogeneity in what drugs we use, how many cycles, whether we treat deeper remissions, whether we switch from bortezomib to carfilzomib. In the European EMN study, it was CyBorD for 3 to 4 cycles across the board. So when you standardize what happens to pre-transplant, it makes a difference, and that's why they may see the benefit of a second transplant. So when we look at these various studies, RVD and ISM was only 3.75 months or 28-day cycles. Forte, as presented by the Italian group, was 8 months. Cassiopeia, which is VTD, was 6 months, and Griffin was only 4.5 months. So the number of cycles of chemo that patients are getting is very different. Next that differs is what kind of growth factor was given. What kind of collection? Was it growth factor or what sign mobilization? So IFM, Forte, and Cassiopeia, all coming from Europe, their default is to use sign mobilization, 2 to 3 grams per meter squared. Griffin, which is an American study, only used plerixafor, no Cytoxan. So when we look at the outcomes, and the most standardized outcome to look at would be what happens to patients after induction chemo, transplant, and restaging. And when we look at the VGPR and better rates, it's 78% for the RVD with transplant, Forte is 89%, Cassiopeia 83%, and Griffin 90.9%. So what do you make of that? They're pretty comparable, but I think this is where the question is, how much chemo did they get? What kind of collection? Was it Cy mobilization or not? And I think this tells us that the Griffin, which is relatively low numbers of cycles of chemo, 4.5, had very good responses. And so I think that's pretty encouraging. And importantly, the Cassiopeia study has already shown that this improvement in depth of VGPR and CRs, the CR rate went from 20 to 29%, translated into PFS benefit of 0.47. So I would say that I think monoclonals plus PI IMID dex is probably going to be the wave of the future. And the difference between carfilzomib and bortezomib is going to be difficult to show because most people are not using Endeavor carfilzomib 56 milligrams per meter squared twice weekly. We know that 56 twice weekly of carfilzomib is better than bortezomib, but what we don't know is in this newly diagnosed setting, in lower doses with other drugs with a monoclonal antibody thrown in, what is going to be that difference? And I think the last point to make about high risk is not all 17p is created equal. We want to know what percentage of cells are deleted with 17p. Is it a monoallelic or biallelic deletion? So I think these are all important considerations. And why is that important? Because, for example, the Tourmaline study showed that in all comers, the ixazomib and IRD seem to do better for high-risk patients. But when then you truly drill down and look at high quantities of 17p deletion or high clonal burden, there was not that benefit. So the definitions of high risk matter. So I would say in 2019, we probably should be using quads. Transplant consolidation is not a bad idea, and probably two drug maintenance would be the approach. And I think the final point to make is that for high risk patients, with the data that we discussed for deepening of responses with monoclonal, we don't know if that truly applies to high risk patients, because in all the forest plots that we see with the addition of CD38, it seems like high-risk patients aren't benefiting as much as standard risk. And so I think people sometimes misinterpret that data. I don't think it means that high-risk patients aren't being benefited by the addition of a monoclonal antibody. It's just that they're not being helped as much. So in other words, we're improving the outcomes of high-risk patients, but we haven't overcome the high risk. So we still have more work to do for these patients, but I think going forward, monoclonals will definitely be playing a role in patients in the near future for newly diagnosed patients as well. So I think with that, that brings us to the end of our discussion for these two cases. We hope you found this helpful, and thank you for your attention.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you would like to learn about the treatment landscape of genitourinary cancers, consider registering for the December 5th State of the Science Summit in Detroit, Michigan. We will also be heading back to Florida to host a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal cancers in Miami on December 17th. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.